part with the government and the Army because they saw Army.
Yeah, I'm familiar with the case.
And
what's your question?
Well, the question was, in this article, it said that this is the first case where they have filed suit against the Army and the government to try to find out more information on that. Are you familiar with the lawsuit on that?
Yes, very familiar with all aspects of that case. In fact, I was the first investigator called on that case, and I put it in the hands of the people that are dealing with it now.
Oh, I see. So it's probably a pretty good case then.
It appears to be on the surface, and I guess we're going to take a break here. Is that right?
That's our walk-in music. Yeah.
Let's get back to that question right after the break, briefly at least.
You want to hang on for about 6 minutes, Herman?
Sure.
We can get into that.
Sure.
It's a good one. Mike asked about a rather interesting case down in Texas. You want to continue along with the subject there?
Yes. The case in question was the Cash Landrum case, Betty Cash and Vicki Landrum. And a young boy, I think he was 7 years old at the time, Colby Landrum, in December of 1980, driving home at night after dark, encounter an unusual object above the highway, stop the car, get out to look at it. It's bright. It's essentially obstructing the road ahead of them. It appears to be in trouble. There's a loud roaring noise. Flame comes out the bottom. Suddenly a bunch of helicopters appear around it. And it seems to get control of itself and takes off across the tree line. They don't know what it was. They're terrified. They think, one of them thinks it's the second coming. They just don't know what to make of it. They get home. They experience physical symptoms, which are quite similar to, in many respects, to radiation poisoning. And they continue to experience physical effects now 3 years after the fact. Quite serious physical effects, as a matter of fact. And the question at issue, of course, is just what is it that they saw? Where did the helicopters come from? The number of independent reports verifying that there were helicopters in the area at the time. The road surface was damaged. There was damage to some of the vegetation in the area. And all of this, of course, makes for a what's going on here type case. Certainly they saw something. The medical effects were caused by something. And the case was investigated largely by John Schussler in Houston, Texas, who was the assistant director, deputy director, of MUFON, the Mutual UFO Network, one of the three major national organizations that deal with UFOs. MUFON has about 900 members, I guess, worldwide, publishes a journal, and has a local chapter here in Los Angeles, as a matter of fact, that's sponsoring this get-together next weekend at the Culver City Civic Auditorium, Saturday afternoon, 1 to 5. And we'll talk some more about that later, but back to Cash Landrum. Schussler did what I would consider to be a credible investigation in many respects, in that he covered a lot of territory in a short amount of time, but he, being only one individual, seemed to have skipped a few points, I guess understandably. But the result was that the Air Force instituted an investigation of their own, or at least they claimed that it was an official investigation through the Judge Advocate General's office and the Inspector General's office, trying to, in essence, get themselves off the hook. And they concluded that they could not show government involvement in the case. They could not produce any evidence which would indicate whose helicopters were there. That's point one. At that point, Peter Gersten, a New York attorney, got involved with it and filed a complaint against the Department of the Air Force on behalf of these people, claiming that the government was responsible at least for the injuries and medical treatment of these people because they were citizens and because the government had an obligation to protect its citizens against whatever this thing was, since it had caused damage. That claim was rejected on the grounds that Gersten had totally failed to connect the injuries, which they didn't deny, with anything which was sponsored by the government. They didn't deny that the incident occurred or that the injuries had occurred. They simply said, we're not responsible because you haven't produced any evidence indicating that we are responsible. And threw the burden in his lap, you see. He appealed that, and in September, a ruling was issued by the Judge Advocate of the Air Force upholding the initial denial on the same grounds that Gersten had failed to in any way implicate the government in the occurrence. And until he could show that they, in fact, were responsible through some action on their part, they claimed that he had no cause of action. And I know that his intention was then to appeal that into federal court in a civil matter and trying to gain judgment against them, against the Air Force. And I assume that he's done that, but I don't really know for certain if he has. And I really have some problems in wondering whether he's going to get anywhere with it, simply because if, in fact, the government was involved in any way, he's going to have one whale of a time in trying to prove it. If they're going to cover it, if they're not going to produce information, and there's certainly provisions within the security and classification procedures which allow members of the military intelligence or military projects to deny the very existence of these things if disclosure would affect the national security.
This takes a short session with the judge.
That's right. And it's happened in the past. So I'm very sympathetic to the problems that these people are having, and I really wish I could do something to alleviate them. But at this point, I don't see a whole lot of hope unless somebody comes out of the woodwork and says, hey, it was the government was involved in this thing in some way, and here's the proof, here's the connection, here's the evidence, and is willing to testify on that behalf that the evidence is authentic. So we're left with a question. Did they see a legitimate UFO? And was some unit of the military aware of its presence, and did they send out what amounted to 20-some-odd helicopters to try to intercept it? And is that what the helicopters were doing there?
Or were they there to help it?
Or were they there to help it, which, of course, is another question. Or, and I feel, I tend to lean more in the direction of a second alternative, and that is that what we, in fact, have run into here is the test of some secret project-type vehicle, which may be nuclear propulsion, and which went out of control and threatened to crash. And they said, hey, guys, we're going down. And the helicopters were sent out to cordon the area off and try to recover the object and keep the public away from it. Now, we know that there has been considerable interest on and off in the area of nuclear propulsion for use within the atmosphere since 1946, going back to the old NEPA project, Nuclear Energy for Propulsion of Aircraft, NEPA. That's almost 40 years ago that considerable research was done, and then the thing slowed up in the 60s, late 60s. But it's possible somebody made a breakthrough and that we, in fact, have developed a nuclear propelled craft, and that it was on a test mission and went out of control, and that's what happened. I tend to believe that that is more realistic in this case than the fact that they encountered a legitimate UFO, simply because of the circumstances. I think that that tends to be more credible. You don't send out 26 or 25 CH-46 helicopters, Chinook helicopters, CH-47s, I guess they are, after a UFO. You send out a fighter interceptor.
Yeah, they're not going to be very effective against
that. Yeah, you don't send out Chinooks loaded to the gills with personnel. You do that if you're going to cordon off an area. If you're going to secure an area and try to protect the public from going in and protect the security of the project involved, then you send out helicopters full of people. But if you're after a UFO, in every case, you send out a fighter interceptor.
Does that help you, Mike? Okay.
Okay, bye.
Thank you for hanging on. Craig, you're on the line now.
Good, boy. You've got a real double bill going tonight.
We'll ignore that.
Bill's
okay,
square.
That's all right.
I have enough trouble with my bills, thanks.
Listen, I've been very interested in the Freedom of Information case suit that was filed, I believe, in 1979 or 80, and went all the way up to the Supreme Court, I believe, several months ago. They finally denied the request on, something like 700 or 800 different documents, and I surmise from your presentation tonight that you are the right person to ask about this.
Sure, what do you want to know?
Well, as much as you'd like to say.
Well, if you could make it a little more specific, I'll try to answer the question.
Craig, you usually hone in better than that.
Okay, why don't you just give us a couple of minutes of what you think are the most pertinent facts regarding this lawsuit.
Well,
and the information that was being sought.
All right, and what you want is a general overview as opposed to some specific question. Yes, I in fact was part of that lawsuit. I was one of five speakers at a press conference at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. when we went to the Court of Appeals with it. I'm on the board of Citizens Against UFO Secrecy, which is the agency that filed the suit. It was filed in 1979 against the National Security Agency, that NSA again, never says anything, people, they had responded to a Freedom of Information Act request saying, yes, we have documents, no, you can't have them. And so we went into federal court in the District of Columbia with an appeal of the denial. And the judge said, all right, gentlemen, how many documents are we actually talking about here? We thought we were talking about 15 or 20. And the spokesman for NSA said, 135. And the mouth is dropped open. So, now that's documents. That's not pages.
Right.
A document might be 100 pages. It might be one.
Right.
Fine. We went on about that. And the argument was made that the public had a right and need to know, and that since the government's position had always been that UFOs don't exist and don't constitute any kind of a threat anyway, there certainly couldn't be anything classified about information relating to them that might be in the files of any government agency.
Really?
And so Judge Gerhard Gesell ruled, he heard the case in September of 1980 at the district court level, and issued a ruling, which I'm madly trying to locate because I've got a copy of it here. And as he thumbs madly through his papers trying to find it so that I can quote directly from it. And you'll hear me shuffling here. There it is. Judge Gerhard Gesell ruled in November the 18th, a ruling of November the 18th of 1980, essentially the following. I'm reading right from the ruling here. Throughout the court's review of this material, the court has been aware of the public interest in the issue of UFOs and the need to balance that interest against the agency's need for secrecy. The in-camera affidavit, I'll get to that in a minute, presents factual considerations which aided the court in determining, and here's the key part, that public interest in disclosure is far outweighed by the sensitive nature of the materials and the obvious effect on national security their release may well entail. Wow. Here's a federal judge saying, hey, folks, you can't have this stuff because if we were to give it to you, it would create an obvious effect on the national security.
Now, isn't it possible that they were referring to the release of information that would reveal surveillance techniques capabilities?
That was their argument. But let's go a little further here.
Right.
What do we mean by the in-camera affidavit? Well, the judge, as was his right under the Freedom of Information Act, requested copies of the documents in question to review in camera, in chambers,
right. In
order to make his ruling. The NSA came back and said, no, 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 you cannot have this stuff, but we will give you an affidavit presenting our reasons why you can't have it. And so they presented the judge with a 21-page top secret UMBRA, UMBRA, which is a classified restricted access type thing above top secret, stating their reasons why the judge couldn't see this stuff. And it was on that alone, he never saw the documents, that he issued this ruling. Well, then we went into the appeals court. And we argued in front of the appeals court. I was in court when the argument was presented. to a three-judge federal panel that the lower court had erred in its ruling, erred in the sense of made an error, in that they had not reviewed the actual documents before making the ruling, as required by the Act. And the three judges heard the arguments. The government attorney, who was one of the assistant attorneys general, get my grammar correct here, made the comment in the hall to our attorney that she, in fact, had seen the 21-page affidavit, top secret, and that she wasn't about to talk about what was in it either, but that it was extremely interesting. Well, we were informed that the court normally took 60 to 90 days to hand down a ruling in cases like this where procedure was involved, probably near to 90 days, and that a ruling would be handed down, we would be informed what it was. And so we sat back, prepared to wait 3 months. 5 days later, the court handed down a ruling, almost as if they had already decided the thing, which said, hey, folks, the lower court was correct, and we are not entertaining any arguments that that this should be reversed. So we went to the Supreme Court with a petition in 1982, in January, to the effect that, please, you know, this certainly ought to be reviewed, that an agency of the government should not have the right to withhold information and then withhold even the reasons from the public as to why it's being withheld. And so the petition was presented to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court reviewed the petition in March of 1982, which is nearly 2 years ago now, and on the 6th of March handed down a ruling which in essence said there is no issue of substance here, and therefore the ruling of both lower courts will stand without review. Now, that's where it's sat. All right, now what are we left with? We're left with two alternatives, trying to find out what they're withholding. So we file a Freedom of Information request for the 21-page affidavit. And we got it. We got 21 pages of blacked out lines, just blank. 80% of the material in that 21 pages, totally censored from the release.
It's fascinating reading, Bill.
It's really great if you like. And you get a copy of it if you want to write to me in Dewey, Arizona. It
takes about 2 seconds to read the whole 21 pages.
Well, a little more than that, but it certainly is there a cover-up? Hell yes, there's a cover-up. The question is what's being covered. So then Moore gets involved with this thing and says, all right, there's got to be a back door here. We've got to find out how long has the NSA been involved with this thing. Do they have, what kind of documentation do they have? How long have they been interested? So what do I uncover? I go through the back door and I start pulling out intelligence files from the Army release, for one thing, 900 and some pages. And I found in that, the Army release, no less than 106 individual reports of unidentified flying objects filed under communications instructions relating to vital intelligence sightings by all branches of the military. And I've got several of them right here in front of me. From 1952 through 1956, and believe me, the file I've got is by no means complete. And who's on the distribution list for every one of these reports? But NSA.
Of course.
Every one of them went to NSA, as well as the CIA, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and, you know, a variety of other places, including Naval Intelligence. And here's one right here I'm looking at, which is dated, what is its date now? I'm looking at it and don't see a date on it. Oh, there it is, 12th August 1954. Stare at it and don't see it. 1954, distribution. CIA, Director NSA, Joint Chiefs of Staff, Situation Room, Air Force, Army Intelligence, etc. Note, this message has been relayed to CIA by electrical means. It says right on the bottom of the thing. And it's a report of an object observed by the tower radar and by visual observation in Maxwell Air Force Base, Alabama, 1954. Well, I've got 105 of these things. I'm there in the early 1950s. What does it say to me? It says to me that NSA, which was established by executive order of President Truman in 1952, was receiving UFO information from day one, 1952. And if I've got 105 of these things, and this is just spotty reports from the early 50s, and they're only claiming they've got 135 documents, somebody somewhere has slipped something. Now, why is this stuff going to NSA?
I would assume that what you've got, what you've been able to get a hold of, doesn't even begin to compare with the stuff you haven't been able to get.
Oh, I'm sure of it, because this stuff is classified, you know, confidential, restricted, a few of them are secret.
Yeah.
It's like pulling teeth to hit high to get what you have.
Yeah, but, you know, you go in through the back door and you suddenly find out that they've been getting this kind of report for a long, long time.
Is a lot of this information going to be covered in the upcoming book, Clear Intent?
Well, I think some of it is. I'm not sure that they have as much information as I have, and they've been dealing mostly. That's Larry Fawcett's book, Clear Intent, done with Barry Greenwood. I know Fawcett pretty well. Greenwood, I've met once or twice, but I really don't know him too well. And that's coming out in April from Prentice Hall Publishers. I think April 1st is the release date on that. If I'm not mistaken, April Fool's Day, of course, has nothing to do with the book. But Larry is pretty thorough. They're dealing mostly with the Northern Tier incidents in 1975, when there were a number of, a whole flurry of reports of unidentified activity over the Northern Tier air bases along the U.S.-Canadian border. And I've got considerable documentation on that subject as well, a reprint of which is available on my list of items which you can get if you want to write to me. And you can read those for yourself. But I think Clear Intent deals pretty much with that. I don't think they have copies of this material from the Army Intelligence File, because I was the one who discovered it, and I haven't sent them any yet. I just got it myself.
Listen, before I let you go, I'd like to ask you one other question. What do you know about sightings in, number one, the Philippines, where we have Clark Air Force Base and Subic Bay Naval Station, the largest of their type in the world, and number two, sightings in Australia, where we have the Pine Gap Station. I believe that's an NSA operation.
It certainly is. I do know that there has been a recent flurry of activity in Australia. Last fall, November, December, lots of activity down in Australia.
Like a flap is still going on.
I think it is. Yeah, I still get some spotty reports from down there. But I don't have any real good details on it, because it's just not something I've been working on. I collect the information, look at it, and say, gee, that's very interesting. But I don't have time to do, you know, I'm one person.
Any comment on the NSA connection there?
Well, no, because I don't know how much connection there is. Certainly, they've got an enormous facility down there.
Yeah.
And certainly, if they're getting any kind of data, it's coming back here. There's no doubt about that. As far as reports from the Philippines, I do have some copies of early ones. Some of this material I was just talking about from the early 50s contain a few from the Philippines. And I don't offhand have enough of that just at the tip of my fingers to be able to cite you a specific case, but I do know that I've looked at a couple of those reports, and that's where they came from. Getting back to reports that went to the NSA, here's a short one, which is not a Philippine case, but I'll just read it because it's so short. 21st August 1953, from Flight Service Hamilton Air Force Base to Director of Intelligence, U.S. Air Force, etc., at 1335 Pacific time, reported unidentified flying objects, and they give latitude, longitude, and so on, appeared to be in formation, then break up and, get this, fly in circles around aircraft. Appeared to have mass of fire in rear.
Flying in circles around aircraft is quite a trick.
That's a neat trick if you can do it, especially in 1953.
Any self-respecting glob of swamp gas can do that, Bill.
Yeah. Now, where did this go? Did it go to Project Blue Book? Which, of course, was the Air Force's official project at the time. No, it didn't. It went to the Director of Intelligence of the Air Force. It went to the Army, the Navy, the Joint Chiefs, the CIA, the NSA, and the OAC, whatever that was. 21st August 1953. Now, that's just a sample of the kind of stuff that is in this file and that NSA was interested in getting copies of. Lord knows what they were doing with it, but from the date of inception, 1952, they're getting this kind of stuff. You know, are they covering up methods and sources as they claim? And that's their argument. We can't give you this stuff because if we did, so-and-so would know that we had intercepted their transmissions of it and they'd change their codes and everything else. And we said, fine, we don't want any information at all which would reveal that kind of information. Take out the places, the names, the dates, paraphrase the information. All we want is the basic UFO data itself. You can censor out anything at all which deals with the place of happening, the sources, materials, and methods, and we're not interested in those things anyway. And they came back and said, we can't disclose this stuff anyway. They wouldn't even give us the dates. Now, what's the date of the document disclosing? But they would not even give us the dates of the documents. And in fact, when they came back and argued to the appeals court, suddenly the 135 documents which they'd been talking about suddenly appeared in print as 171. So it had grown again.
Does that help you, Craig?
Well, not enough, of course. We'd like those documents.
Sure would.
Wouldn't we all?
Listen, Bill, I want to thank you for some very provocative programs. I'm going to be moving at the beginning of February, and I don't know if I'll talk to you again before I move.
Oh, we're going to miss you, Craig.
Well, you're
going
to be around on the 28th, and you certainly can show up down here in Culver City.
I wish. I just hope that you're going to get this program on the network soon so I can get it in Northern California.
Well, we certainly hope so, too.
Okay. Thank you much.
Okay. Very bright young man who calls in quite often. We'll get right back to Bill Moore and our callers in just a moment. I'm Bill Jenkins. It's Open Mind. Hello, everybody.
Many, many ways that we know that that Blue Book simply was not the end of the line. Let's take a brief look here at a memo written in 1969 by General Carol Bolander, Brigadier General, U.S. Air Force, who was Deputy Director of Development and Research. And he's writing a simple memo on the subject of UFOs, unidentified flying objects, 20th October 1969. And what does he say? If Blue Book, which the public has been led to believe all along, was the end of the line for UFO reports, then why would a brigadier general say something like this? Moreover, reports of unidentified flying objects which could affect the national security are not part of the Blue Book system. And then he goes on to say again, in the same memo, however, as already stated, reports of UFOs which could affect national security would continue to be handled through the standard Air Force procedures designated for this purpose. Now, 1969, you know, Blue Book was on its way out at that time. And here's General Bolander saying reports which could affect the national security never went to Blue Book. They were handled outside. They're not part of the system.
I think you have some documentation that involved J. Edgar Hoover, in fact, in the investigation of crash UFOs.
He was complaining as far back as July 15th of 1947, just after the Roswell case, that the Army Air Force was not cooperating with the FBI in sharing information with respect to disks recovered. He specifically says that.
Mm-hmm.
And he's complaining about, in a specific instance, they would not even let our people have a cursory examination of it. And, you know, he personally wrote that on the bottom of a rather innocuous memorandum, sort of petulantly complaining that these people weren't letting him in on things. And, you know, that brings us to another point. Is there still classified information about UFOs that has yet to be released? We've seen at this point in time, under Freedom of Information, probably between 5,000 and 6,000 documents that have come out. the great percentage of which are just garbage. They're newspaper clippings or their internal correspondence that deal with it. Well, just nothing. But about 10% are more than just of passing interest, and a very small number of them actually say something. None of the documents yet released bears a classification, original classification, higher than secret, with the exception of the heavily censored NSA affidavit we just talked about. Were there top secret documents? Because if there were, if we can find any evidence at all that those things existed, then certainly something has yet to come out. Here's a memo from January of 1949. And I'll just read the pertinent part. At recent weekly intelligence conferences, and I'm going to paraphrase here, the matter of unidentified aircraft or unidentified aerial phenomena, otherwise known as flying discs, flying saucers, and balls of fire, have been discussed. And then the key part of this. This matter is considered top secret by intelligence officers of both the Army and the Air Forces. In black and white. Top secret. In 1949. Where are those documents? Where are those records?
They're still top secret.
They're still top secret. We haven't seen anything from that time frame or later which bears that kind of classification. We've seen confidential and restricted and even a few secret, but we've seen nothing above that.
Mm-hmm.
Are they still collecting UFO reports? Here's a regulation, current regulation, from JCS Publication 6, Volume 5, Joint Chiefs of Staff material. Current regulation. This report provides for the peacetime reporting of intelligence sightings of vital importance to the security of the United States and Canada. What do they want? What kind of sightings? What material? The following specific sightings will be reported. Hostile or unidentified single aircraft or formations of aircraft which appear to be directed against the United States or Canada or their forces. Clearly, unidentified aircraft. Missiles. Hostile or unidentified submarines. Hostile or unidentified groups of military surface vessels. And, as a separate category, not unidentified aircraft, unidentified flying objects. Current regulation, right out of the JCS publication for 1983, do they want reports on UFOs which might affect the national security? There it is in black and white.
The Joint Chiefs of Staff still work on it then.
The Joint Chiefs of Staff are collecting reports, and where do you suppose they go? NSA.
And to the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
Oh, and to the Joint Chiefs.
Shall we go to another caller here, see what is on Dan's mind? Dan?
Hello.
Yeah.
Hi, Bill.
Mm-hmm.
Hello, Bill.
Hello.
Listening to all this stuff, I think it's fantastic that you folks have this information. You must have done a tremendous amount of research to get all these documents.
Well, I'm not going to brag about it because it's not something to brag about, but unfortunately, the UFO field is such that there just aren't a lot of people doing research more than on a part-time basis. And somebody pointed out to me on a show a couple of years ago that I must be the only full-time professional journalist who deals full-time with UFOs in North America. And I thought about that for a moment and says, well, by golly, I think you're right. There isn't anybody else. I sometimes wish that wasn't so. That's not an honor. That's a disgrace. There ought to be dozens of people into this field, but there aren't.
I absolutely agree. And personally, of course, I'm a part-time researcher, you know, things that you do in the evening and after work. And I've been involved in doing this kind of thing for a couple of years. And I've read your book. I've read numerous other books and articles. And you start getting a picture that, for instance, going over your book, I was just, you know, one of my favorite parts of your book is a letter from Gerald Light to Ben Lane in California. About the incident that occurred as far as Ike coming to survey the craft, and all the scientists apparently pretty much in chaos and confusion, etc. But, you know, even since then, there's so much information that's come out. Leonard Stringfield has a hoard of reports about crashed saucers or landed saucers. There's a number of people out, for instance, a guy called Virgil Armstrong. Are you in contact with him?
Well, I know who Virgil is. That's not his real name.
Okay, well.
But, yes, and I've got some real problems with some of the material that he has come out with, but go ahead.
Well, there seems to be so much information coming out, and especially since this Roswell incident occurred in 1947, which is 37 years ago, I have a feeling that, although, of course, there's a lot of information to be taken out of the government, that the government is very, very much playing with us, too, because 37 years ago, if they got hold of any type of craft, and they've been doing kind of research at least for 37 years ago, the advances that they have made are just so way beyond anything that we could probably even come up with right now. Even think, you know, we're still trying to get at the government to come out with papers that flying saucers exist. I have a feeling that the government has done so much research that they're so far ahead of us that we can't, we're not, you know, the questions we're posing to them are the same kind of questions we're still posing in the early 50s. Now, where do you think the government has gone at this point, as far as their own research is? If Leonard Stringfield is right as far as his information is, there's been tremendous research and probably advancements. I mean, you don't stay at one position for 37 years.
Well, that's a tough question to answer unless you have some inside information. Let's take it apart at the seams and deal with it on specific issues. First of all, if we can buy the idea that we've got a crashed craft in whatever condition we recovered it, and certainly there's a great deal of evidence that that is the fact. I've talked to something like 90 different people who have substantiated that story in one way or another, and 30 of them firsthand. That's an awful lot of people. You know, you get one or two witnesses, that's one thing, but 30 different people who essentially don't know each other telling the same story and saying, yep, that's what it was, I was there. Seven of them handled bits and pieces of wreckage. Two have claimed to see bodies. You know, that kind of thing. that's just pretty spectacular. Excuse me. We have a Canadian memorandum all the way from 1950. This one was top secret, but it's Canadian, not U.S., and it somehow slipped past a couple of the Canadian government people. I don't feel that it should have been released, because I think they read page one and didn't read page two, and that's what happened, because on page two, it says, I made discreet inquiries through the Canadian embassy staff in Washington who were able to obtain for me the following information. The matter of UFOs is the most highly classified subject in the United States government, rating higher even than the H-bomb in 1950. That was 2 years away from its first test explosion. B. Flying saucers exist. C. Their method of operation is unknown, but concentrated effort is being made by a small group headed by Dr. Vannevar Bush. Now, there we've got the guy who seems to have been the leader of the technological team that got into this thing. And D. The entire matter is considered by the United States authorities to be of tremendous significance. Now, here's a top-secret Canadian memo from 1950. Making a statement like that. And, of course, they never intended for that kind of a thing to get released. But if we look into Vannevar Bush and who he was and what he was, and that's a long story in its own right, we find that he was just the individual that you would have chosen had you been in a position to choose anybody to handle that kind of a project. We've got another guy coming forth just recently, scientist, Ph.D., who knew Bush and who's said on the record and in writing that Bush indeed was involved in a thing like this and that there were bodies and that there was a project going on at that time and that he wasn't part of it, but he was aware of it. And this is a guy who was one of the dollar-a-year men back in the 40s during the war and so on, prominent scientist, well-known, now up in years and retired, on the record with that kind of a statement. We have Senator Goldwater, who comes along and says he's made inquiries trying to get this kind of information, and he's given up because nobody will give it to him. This thing, and this is Goldwater writing, this thing has gotten so highly classified, even though I will admit that there is a lot of it that has been released, it's just impossible to get anything on it. Senator Goldwater, 1981. Senator Goldwater, 1975, made an effort to find out 10 or 12 years ago, he says, in 75, what was going on at Wright-Patterson. And I was understandably denied this request. It's still classified above top secret. Senator Goldwater in 1983. I've no idea who controls the flow of need to know because, frankly, I was told in such an emphatic way that it was none of my business that I've never tried to make it my business since. Now, this is a guy who was candidate for president of the United States making a statement like that. 1983. you know, what do you make of something like that? Clearly, the project is going on. Somebody is interested. If they got a crashed craft, somebody was interested in technology, and I think that's the reason for secrecy today. The technology, of course, may be so far ahead of us, even now. What's 35 years? Sure, we've made great advances since the war in 1945. But if that craft was 1,000 years or 5,000 or 1,000,000 years ahead technologically, we're still not going to make any kind of a dent in what the thing was. It's like handing Thomas Edison a microchip and saying, here, Tom, tell us what this is, what it does, and see if you can make one like it. And that's only 100 years ago. That's not so far back. There are my favorite analogy of landing an F-18 or F-19 fighter plane in a crash landing one in a field outside of Washington, D.C. in the middle of the Civil War, 120 years ago, technologically speaking and historically speaking. How long does it take Lincoln's best scientists to figure out what it is, how it works, duplicate it, and put one in use against the Confederacy? With the technology of 120 years ago, absolutely impossible. And that's not so far back. You know, that's only a few generations back in time. Let me change the subject just briefly and encourage all of our listeners out there, first of all, to get on my mailing list. If you want information about documentation, publications, and so on available, write to me. Bill Moore, Dewey, Arizona, D-E-W-E-Y, Arizona, 86327. And if you can't remember the zip code, don't worry about it, because Dewey, Arizona is only one place. It's a small town, and I'm the only Bill Moore with a mailbox there. So just write, and if nothing else, say, put me on your mailing list, and I'll sure do that and send you out some information telling you what's available, how you can get copies of some of this stuff that I've been talking about here tonight. The other thing is to encourage everyone out there, and if they all showed up, we'd be in trouble, wouldn't we, Bill?
Yep.
To come to the What's New in UFOs seminar, which is next Saturday afternoon, January the 28th, beginning about noon and going on till about 5 o'clock. Stanton Friedman, myself, one other lecturer, Civic Auditorium here in Culver City, Veterans Memorial Building, Civic Auditorium, corner of Overland Boulevard and Culver Boulevard. And there is an admission, $6 at the door.
You got three bills. Hello, Bill.
Bill Moore.
Yes.
This is Bill Steinman. I stayed up late for a change to talk to you, just because you're talking about my subject matter.
Well, you usually talk to me early and wake me up in the morning, so in this case you're talking to me late. How are you doing?
Fine. I was going to bring up the subject matter, but you already touched on it, about the Canadian connection there with a... with our Wilbur Smith. You didn't get into detail about Wilbur Smith's memo, the letter that he wrote, his research notes, which talked about his discreet inquiries he made prior to the memo that you just mentioned that came out.
That is true, and I purposely avoided that simply because to get into that would take a great deal more time than we have, but I can point out that it is covered in a paper which I presented, and I'm sure you're aware of that because you were one of the people there, Bill, called UFOs Uncovering the Ultimate Answer, and that's available as a publication. Again, if you write to me, I'll send you a flyer on that one, and that goes into the Wilbert Smith thing. The newest thing, and I'm glad you brought him up again because that gets me back into it, the newest thing is a memo by Smith dated August 10th, 1953, which I just got. And, in fact, I was going to call you on this one tomorrow morning, but you beat me to it.
Send me a copy of it.
I'll give you a copy of it, sure.
Okay.
In which Smith says that we have concluded that a significant number of the sightings are probably due to some kind of vehicles, and that we can get a glimpse of the technology which makes them possible. We do not claim that the case for alien vehicles is proven by any means, but we do believe that there is sufficient evidence to warrant a scientific investigation on a reasonable scale to find out what these objects are and how they operate. Now, this is, of course, Smith talking to the Canadian government about his own activities and about his own findings with respect to UFOs on the Canadian scene in 1953, and concluding, based upon the study that they had already done, that there was a high probability that some kind of extraterrestrial vehicle was involved, and urging the Canadian government to do something more than they were already doing with it.
Wasn't Smith already convinced